From the business desk at State Broadcast News, this is the CRE News Hour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. It's Friday, August 16th, 2019. On this week's edition of the CRE News Hour, we'll have part one of a two-part conversation with attorney Brad Malotsky, a leading expert on the Federal Opportunity Zones program. We'll have a conversation with Mark Rose, the chief executive officer of global real estate firm Avis & Young, which is expanding dramatically in 20 countries around the globe, and a look at how Investors Bank, a regional bank in New Jersey, is growing its commercial real estate lending portfolio as a balance sheet lender. We'll talk to their chief lending officer, Rich Spengler. We'll be back with the top CRE news stories right after these messages.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. Thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour. We'd just like to make note of a new option on the show page for this episode. You can click on the purple Take the Survey button right below the podcast player and share some information that will help us get to know our audience better. We'd also appreciate your considering financial support for the CRE News Hour by visiting our Patreon link and becoming a show supporter. Now let's take a look at some of the stories that are moving CRE markets across the country. Fannie Mae's economists say a stronger-than-expected first half of the year pushed its forecast for full-year 2019 headline growth up slightly to 2.2%. That's despite the escalating trade conflict and the associated risks of financial market volatility, labor market weakness, and loss of consumer resiliency. Fannie Mae's economist group also updated its domestic monetary policy expectations, and it's calling for two more quarter-point interest rate cuts by the Federal Reserve in 2019, one in September and another in December. Consumer spending continues to be the primary driver of growth, increasing in the second quarter at its strongest pace since the end of 2017, while a surge in government non-defense spending, mainly due to the resumption of uninterrupted employee compensation following the government shutdown, also contributed to strong growth in the first half. By contrast, residential fixed investment dragged in the sixth consecutive quarter, while business investment turned negative in the face of increasing trade and geopolitical uncertainty. Rent Cafe says average rents in and around Philadelphia have seen minimal changes compared to June, and in some cases, the rents decreased slightly. The pace is consistent with the national trend as the U.S. average rent grew by $3 compared to the previous month and now reached $1,469. In Philadelphia, average apartment rents reached $1,624 in July. That's a $2 increase compared to last month. The highest rents in the area are in King of Prussia, where the average is $1,669, lower by $2 compared to June. CBRE arranged a $20 million sale of the Bergen Medical Center in Paramus, New Jersey. The buyer is a private investor and acquired the 75,000-square-foot medical office property from the Eye Institute of New Jersey. Built in 1988, Bergen Medical Center is on approximately 5 acres in one of the county's healthcare arteries off Route 17. The property is near Valley Medical Center, Bergen Regional Medical Center, and Hackensack University Medical Center. CBRE also arranged for Fashionphile, an online fashion resale website where consumers can buy and sell used women's luxury designer handbags and jewelry. They're going to lease 105,000 square feet in Moonaki, New Jersey. EverWest Real Estate Investors is redeveloping the building, which the firm purchased in August 2017. Accounting firm Eisner Amper signed a 15-year lease for 125,000 square feet on the 6th through 9th and part of the 10th floors of 733 3rd Avenue in New York City. Also included in the deal is 1,150 square feet on the building's ground floor for a private entrance area, lobby, and hospitality area for Eisner employees and their guests, and a 2,100 square foot outdoor terrace on the 7th floor. 733 3rd Avenue is owned by the Durst Organization. It's on the southeast corner of 3rd Avenue and East 46th Street. It's LEED Gold certified. 11 buildings that comprise what is known as the Post Office and Warehouse District at the decommissioned Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, are under contract for purchase for redevelopment. Oport Partners, a company owned by Denholz Properties, is going to replace the existing buildings with three Class A office buildings for a total of 86,000 square feet. They'll be targeting medical, biotech, and technology companies. Everest Rehabilitation Hospitals is putting up a sixth physical rehab hospital. It's in the Liberty Township section near North Cincinnati, Ohio. Everest's modern comprehensive medical rehabilitation hospital will be constructed on a little over 5 acres just north of Cincinnati. The site's located at the northeast corner of Interstate 75 and Bethany Road in Liberty Township. And some executive moves of note. CBRE's appointed John Poulos to head its healthcare practice, delivering client solutions in the areas of compliance, facilities management, project management, advisory and transaction, and consulting services to healthcare systems throughout the country. CBRE Healthcare is a dedicated business group within the company focused exclusively on partnering with healthcare providers to deliver total lifecycle real estate, facility, and capital solutions. Based in Cleveland, Poulos first joined CBRE in 1997. Cushman & Wakefield veteran Thomas Collins is joining Avis & Young as a principal, and he'll be managing director of the company's New England region. He'll manage day-to-day operations of Avis & Young's Boston and Hartford offices. He most recently operated Collins Strategies, a consulting firm providing coaching and mentoring services for real estate companies and professionals. And Ratliff Companies, a hardscape construction and real estate development company near Dallas, has named Brian Robertson as chief executive officer. Robertson steps into the CEO role after leading the company as president since 2008 and acquiring the company in 2012. Ratliff offers general construction, concrete, and masonry services for all civil and hardscape projects, including single-family, multifamily, commercial, municipal, and oil and gas. You're listening to the CRE NewsHour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. The Federal Opportunity Zone program is being implemented differently in almost every state. Some states offer additional incentives or creative ways for developers to partner with state and municipal governments to take advantage of the federal OZ tax credits on projects that also serve the public good. One of the leading experts on the Opportunity Zone program is Brad Malotsky. Brad's co-head of the Opportunity Zones practice group at the Philadelphia-based law firm of Duane Morris. Brad's primary practice is focused in the areas of Opportunity Zone fund creation and fund deployment, financing, public-private partnership, which you sometimes hear called PPP or P3, real estate joint ventures, and commercial leasing, including a focus in cannabis leasing. And we'll have to have him back on the program to discuss cannabis in greater detail at a later date. Before joining Duane Morris, Brad was on the big development company side of things. He spent 2 decades as executive vice president, general counsel, and corporate secretary of Brandywine Realty Trust, where he oversaw the real estate investment trust's legal operations, acquisitions and divestitures, financings, joint ventures, board matters, insurance procurement, litigation oversight, SEC filings, and the legal aspects of capital raising. Brad's office is just about 10 minutes from our studios, so he dropped into State Broadcast News to talk about Opportunity Zones. Brad, thanks for joining us on the program.
Pleasure.
So you are heavily into monitoring the Opportunity Zone programs around the country, and there have been a couple of changes recently that you are updating your clients and prospects on. Talk a little bit about the FHA program for financing first.
So there's a recent FHA announcement last week whereby they took one of their programs, their Section 202 program, which is a loan program for certain types of housing in certain particular locations, and they essentially attached it to the Opportunity Zone, saying that if you did an OZ deal with a 202 loan, they were providing additional incentives, which is a nice way of underlining, reiterating that the Opportunity Zone program is a stackable benefits program, meaning it's not use one benefit or another. It layers nicely on top of or alongside of any number of other tax credit and or other loan programs from the federal government. So historic tax credits, film credits, new markets credits, all work with or can work with Opportunity Zone equity. And so what the FHA was saying in this instance, HUD kind of expanded its programming to say, hey, if and to the extent you are doing an Opportunity Zone deal in one of our, you know, kind of locations that qualify for this program under 202, we're going to sort of put you to the top of the line, front of the line. And so that's for a developer, kind of the ability to not have to wait to know whether you're in or out is a benefit. Time is kind of a bit of a killer in some of these instances. So it's nice to see the federal government looking to align programming with the Opportunity Zone program, which will provide additional incentive and or push for folks to utilize the program.
And as you mentioned, the stackable nature of the Opportunity Zone that a lot of the other folks we've had on the program talking about OZs have made the point that you structure the investment to be a good investment first, and then the Opportunity Zone is sort of like the icing on the cake or the gravy.
Icing on the cake, exactly. And I think that's spot on. The real estate transaction, if you're going down that path, you could go down the business path. But the real estate transaction needs to make sense on its own. You know, the tax benefit does not make it make sense. So if the real estate deal pencils and it's a good deal, this provides additional kind of sizzle to that transaction that's already a good transaction.
So one of the things you've done, you share with your network of interested parties a long list of all the different changes and features on a state-by-state basis. What are some of the interesting things that are happening on the state level?
Yeah, so I'm never sure if anybody reads that stuff, Steve, but I do pass it along. And occasionally I get some feedback that people appreciate it. And it's a little bit hard to tell. It's almost like when you go into a room and you're meeting people. Most real estate folks, many business people have heard about the Opportunity Zone program, but some have delved into it. Some have read an article. Some have kind of listened. And this stuff, it's not that hard. There's only like three basic benefits and three basic rules. But then there's a lot of nuance below the surface. And so I'm never sure whether the person we're talking to is kind of a 101 learner, a 201, or a 301. And so it's the ability to sort of share information and people can digest, you know, at their leisure. And so the thing you're alluding to that I passed out was from a piece from Novogradic, which is, again, an online resource. They provide accounting services and they do webinars and seminars and that kind of stuff. And they tend to have a very good warehouse of information that's available in different formats. And so one of their authors had put forth a discussion about the different states and kind of where they're at. So some states are very much ahead of the curve. South Carolina has its own OZ person that's in charge of their program. And that person is out and about and talking to communities and thinking about kind of what should go on and can we use, for instance, Opportunity Zone money to create interest in building schools in areas where we can't afford to do them. And so he's thinking about macro level building 30 schools. Well, that's a couple $100 million. So can he attract equity capital at a decent rate relative to utilizing Opportunity Zone capital gains, put them into a fund or have somebody put them into a fund, use that fund to finance these buildings that the school districts can't afford? That's fascinating. And so kind of marrying P3, public-private partnerships, with Opportunity Zone equity to show kind of a return, have that lease payment backed up by either a state agency or a county agency if it's a school, and execute on infrastructure is kind of fascinating. So the different states are taking different approaches. Some of them, big picture. So the federal program is a federal program, And essentially when you sell, there are certain ramifications from the sale. If it's after 10 years, it's federally capital gains tax-free on the appreciated value. At this point, as of 2 or 3 weeks ago, there were 38 states that had followed federal form. In English, they said, hey, if you come to our state and you build or adaptively reuse or create a business or real estate in our state, we too, so long as you follow the federal rules, we too will waive off on our state capital gains. So 38 states out of 50 have done that. And that's meaningful in certain states. Like, for instance, New York, that's like 11.2% out of additional benefit. In New Jersey, it's like 8.64%. So in addition to the federal non-payment after 10 years on the sale, these states have also said, hey, if you do it here, we too. And so how one uses that, either straight up or you start to tack benefits along with that. So some states are looking at, how do we incent rural development? So if you do that, we're going to give you a state benefit. How do you focus on larger cities in some states? So if you do it in a city, you're going to get certain benefits. Others are like Ohio early on came out with a job credit. So if you created jobs, you were going to get additional benefits under the OZ. So the OZ doesn't require federally you to create jobs. In Ohio, they were trying to incent the jobs. And so they said, if you created jobs in our opportunity zone, we will give you certain additional things. And so these states are kind of taking different tacks, different approaches based on what they're looking to incent behavior-wise in order to attract that kind of capital and get that type of adaptive reuse. Others are taking a look at and saying, hey, we have a bunch of vacant buildings. And so we want you to focus on vacant buildings. And if you do an adaptive reuse of a vacant building, we'll give you an added, you know, state tax benefit. So again, there are these 38 states and there's a variety of states, you know, Alabama, California, Connecticut, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maryland, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Texas, that are kind of doing different things to create energy and interest in the development community to come to their state and to invest capital in their state and either create a business or build a building or adaptively reuse a building.
Now, isn't there a bit of a rush for people to do their projects or get the projects on at least in the pipeline because there's a time constraint?
A lot of people are under the misperception that the program ends after this year. That is not true, NOT. What the rush to judgment is this year is the benefits, one of the benefits, so the three benefits are deferral, pay later, reduction. If you're in the program for 5 years, you get to reduce by 10%. 7 years, you get to reduce by 15%. And then if you stay in the program for 10 years, the appreciated value, and you sell before 2047, 1231, 2047, that sales price on the appreciated value is not federally taxed. So to go back to your question, when we say 5 years in the program, 7 years in the program, the deferral in the program is till 2026. And so if you count backwards 7 years from 2026, that puts us in squarely into 2019, which is this year. And so if one has capital gains and one puts those capital gains into a fund, qualified opportunity fund, by 12/31 of this year, so 12/31/19, those dollars are eligible for a 15% reduction because they have 7 years until the end of 2026. If you miss this year and you happen to do that on January 2nd of 2020, the sky does not fall. However, you're not eligible for the 15% reduction. You're eligible for deferral, first benefit, till 2026. You're also eligible for a 10% reduction because there's enough time, 5 years, to get to 2026. And so if you did it in 2019, you'd be eligible for 15%. If you did it in 2020 or 2021, you're eligible for 10% reduction. If you don't do it in either of those 2 years, the sky doesn't fall again. You're just not eligible for as much deferral and you don't get any reduction, but you're still eligible for if you stay in the zone for 10 years and thereafter sell before the end of 2047, you still get the benefit of the sales price appreciation not being subject to federal capital gains tax.
Is that one of the most difficult things for people to understand about the program, or what are the questions you get from people asking about the nuances of it?
So the questions are, there's not one question. I'm on the phone 2, 3, 4 times a day with different people that look and want to engage in the conversation of what we're doing, you know, you and what we're talking about now. And so some of them are beginners, some of them are intermediates, and some of them are extremely advanced. And so depending on where you're at on the space-time continuum there, or the OZ continuum, I guess, their questions are all different. So some people want to talk about businesses and what kind of business and when could I incorporate and what state should I be incorporated. Other people want to talk about well, I want to build real estate and I own the property already. So how do I do that? So that's a whole different set of related party rules. And are you willing to sell and then reinvest in the property? Still others want to understand about refinancing, or they have land, or they will have vacant buildings, or what's this original use thing? And so the questions run the gamut. So yesterday's question was, I want to build a distillery. You know, can I do that? Well, one of the sin...
Can you?
Well, it's a great question. So one of the sin businesses, you can't sell liquor. So there's like six sin businesses or seven. So it's no golf course, no gambling, no sale of liquor, no massage parlor, no tanning salon, and no horse racing. Those the sin businesses come from and have their underpinning in the new markets tax credits world, which is like 10, 15 years old. So somebody says, well, I want to create a distillery. So I said, okay, let's talk about that. Are you talking about the business or are you talking about the real estate? Well, either or both. Okay, let's talk about the business. So your business is going to be buying product, putting it into a tank for all intents and purposes, and creating something, a spirit or beer or whatever. Yes. Okay. Are you going to sell it to a third party? Yes, we're going to sell it to stores to sell. Okay, so far so good. There's no, you're not selling liquor for consumption by an individual. That's kind of where they don't want.
It's the difference between a bar and a manufacturing.
Yes, a little bit, but it's not clear. Okay. And so it's kind of like, well, distribution versus sale to individual for drinking. Okay, well then fine, you're selling to a third party. Let's then slice the onion a little thinner. What about if you're selling, you got a tasting room? Is it free? Or are you giving it away? You know, are you giving it away or are you selling? Well, I don't know. Okay, let's assume you're selling. Well, is that the sale of liquor that is what's prohibited? What if that sale of liquor was $1,000 of value versus the sale of the product, which is $1 million? So you had 0.01% of your value was in the sale of liquor. Would that be enough? And the IRS is unclear on this point. What if you sold food? And liquor was an incidental part of it. So back to your point, what's the difference between a restaurant and a bar? Or a bar and a packaging store?
Right. In New Jersey now, with the microbreweries, right, we have people going for tastings, and there are specific rules about how many times a year they can do events.
That's
and
right.
And what you can give people.
Food.
Right.
Right. And so part of that has nothing to do with this, but there's a whole kind of lure around liquor and distillery and brewery. And kind of food and beverage intersection. So there's different, concerns there, lobbying interests as to, one being the other. And if you're in the business of distilling, you're not supposed to be in the business of selling food. And so the bars were kind of taking a position there. So that all plays into this question of this person wants to spend a bunch of money, create the distillery, essentially sell product to a third party. But, as an ancillary side business, they would have a tasting to bring people in to learn about the thing. And so I said, look, that should work, but it's not totally clear. And again, if that tasting and that on-site consumption and walkout business all of a sudden became material, that becomes more problematic because then it starts to look more like a liquor store, which is bad, versus not. The distillery would be fine. Take the same point for casino. So gambling, not okay. So I've talked to a couple of casinos about, have you paid attention to this? And then the answer, no, not really, because we're a sin business. Well, that's true. But what if, think about, pick your favorite casino. If you walk in there, the casino is not just gambling. There's a hotel piece. There's a recreational piece. There's pools. There's parking. And then there's a hotel. And then there's the gambling floor. So if one was able to legally separate those pieces, why wouldn't the opportunity zone investment apply to the pieces that were non-gambling? And the answer is they will. And so if you created legal separation through like a condominium structure and you put the gambling floor in one condominium unit and you put the other pieces in another unit or five, those units that were non-gambling would be eligible for opportunity zone investment.
Or would you have casino parking deck LLC?
Yeah, is that how you would? Yeah, exactly. Or casino floor LLC. Uh-huh. You kind of put it to the side. That would not be eligible for the dollar investments or for kind of the benefits. But if you got capital investment in the other pieces, it would be eligible.
Brad Malotsky is co-head of the Opportunity Zones practice at the Philadelphia-based law firm of Duane Morris. Brad will be back with the second part of this conversation about Opportunity Zones in next week's CRE NewsHour. We'll have a link to his contact information in the show notes for this episode. You're listening to the CRE News Hour from statebroadcastnews.com. Toronto-based Avison Young has been consistently named one of Canada's best-managed companies for the past 8 years in a row. And in 2018, the firm achieved platinum status in the survey conducted by accounting firm Deloitte. The company's experienced rapid growth over the past decade, particularly in recent years. Mark Rose, the Chief Executive Officer of Avison Young, is joining us to talk about the company's culture, growth strategy, and his outlook for the CRE markets worldwide. In 11 years with the Toronto-based firm, Mark's overseen growth from 290 real estate professionals in just 11 offices in Canada to about 5,000 professionals in 120 offices in 20 countries. Mark, thanks for joining us on the CRE NewsHour.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about what's going on with Avison Young. You have been expanding rather dramatically over the past year or so. What is your approach and how do you think things are changing in the commercial real estate industry?
You know, in terms of what we're doing, it really has to do with an environment that's changing, an industry that's changing. And not having the legacy platform to have to deal with, we have a 10-year-old company that its systems are all cloud-based and people were brought on with the understanding that in a changing environment, that we want to settle on a couple of core beliefs. And those core beliefs are around culture. Honesty and integrity can't just be words. They are the driving force of what we do. But what goes along with that is a collaboration and communication, engaging diverse opinions, caring about inclusion rather than excluding opinion. And so when you build a company of that sort, it takes on a very different structure and a very different set of rules. For example, we have the NAR, which with no smirk intended, it's the no asshole rule. And it's been a part of our thesis from the very beginning that service companies are here to service their clients, and we cannot afford to have difficult personalities or individuals that think about themselves before they think about their clients or the people who work with them. And so in direct answer to your question, because we've seen so much change in the industry and how we serve as clients, and because there is much, much more coming, you know, with rapid change, it's being driven by a maturity of the industry, the changing of the guard in terms of owners of real estate and folks that service them. And obviously, when artificial intelligence and certain technologies actually work, these are all things that will change how we do business. And you have to have the organization that's prepared for it. So for us, Avison Young's growth has been quite methodical. You know, the strategy was written and finished from 2007 to 2008. 2008, we took a document and we launched a company. The Avison Young company was the company that we started with, but it was actually a document first. And what that document was let's headquarter a company outside the US because we want to demonstrate global. Nothing to do with, you know, any issues with the U.S., just the competitive set are headquartered there. And let's build something that will hold a World Series and actually invite the world. And then we're going to do it with a private partnership, and we're going to structure the company that clients come first. And I say this not because our competitors are bad. Actually, you know, they're quite good. But the structures of these companies, if you're a public company, you are beholden to public shareholders and you have a fiduciary, a legal responsibility to drive and solve the needs of only one stakeholder, and that is the public shareholders. And therefore, you have to structure the company accordingly. And it's only off the backs of, you know, top talent and good management teams that you expand past the structure to deliver services. Well, at Avis & Young, we are not beholden to the public shareholder. We are completely beholden to the clients and to the partners and the people who work here. And so we have methodically gone out over the last 10 years and rounded up individuals first in a Canada, then in the US, then in the UK, Germany, now expanding into places like Italy and Ireland and Spain and Hong Kong and Moscow and Austria that came as part of the GVA worldwide network. And so this 11 office Canadian company with 293 people and 40 million of revenue is now in 120 offices in 20 countries around the world with 5,000 people at over $1 billion of revenue. And there's much, much more to go for us.
It's an incredible story of rapid growth. And I wonder, as you've been on that journey, how the company deals with that kind of growth on such a short time frame. It's a couple of orders of magnitude bigger than it was when you started that 11-year journey.
Yeah, it's more than 25 times its size right now, which is pretty, we're proud of it. But everything is based on culture. So, for example, we just effectively acquired a company in Washington, D.C., called the Ezra Company. And we worked it out that we took 9 of the 50 employees and we didn't take the other 41 just because they didn't fit. And it's not that they're bad people. They just didn't fit with what we were trying to do. And when you focus in on the human element and the type of people who you want around the table, we saw the brand elevating top talent being vested in 9. And we had no issues with saying the other 41 should probably go and do other things. And that's not the first time that we've done this. We handpick the individuals who come in. And at the moment, I'm looking between individuals, teams, and companies who are engaged with us right now. We are actively reviewing over $2 billion of run rate revenue of people who would like to join Avis & Young.
That's
an addition to what we have.
That's enormous. I mean, how do you ensure that everything remains consistent? It must take a long time to integrate those properties when people come aboard. How do you keep that straight?
Perfect example, the acquisition of GVA on February 1st of this year almost doubled the size of the company. So what did we do? I moved to London. I'm here with the team, and other parts of the management exec have been here to make sure that we are properly integrating the organization and making sure, because it's never perfect, but making sure that the needs of everyone from one culture to another culture are put together as best as we can. And so you just take the time. And you focus in on how do we build the best company with this umbrella belief system of getting people to work together and collaborating and communicating, fully understanding that as you go country to country, there are different subcultures. So put the SWAT teams on from the strategy teams to the M&A teams to the specific merger integration teams. We opened up a project management office, and all of this work is being done, humans talking to other humans and making very tough decisions when we need to, to grow the organization. And it's going really well. And you'll continue to see this. Back in the early days, if we opened up a city in the US, partners from Canada and initial US offices would come and integrate the team. And then as more and more offices opened in the US, more of the U.S. offices were able to integrate the teams. And now with international expansion, senior leadership integrates the acquisitions. You can't just pull these pieces together and expect them to work. You need to make sure that you're talking to the individuals and getting the belief system down. After that, everything works.
Do you spend an enormous amount of your time on the road? You said you moved to London to help with that integration. Do you, when you're not, you know, sitting in the office for an integration of a new member company or partnership, are you traveling a lot?
Well, let's just say this. Before the acquisition earlier this year, last year I flew every other day. So
you see a lot of airports.
You see an awful lot of airports. But you know what? This is a people business. Our clients a demand, and quite frankly, they deserve being across the table. And our people equally should be with, you know, the leadership team, not just hear them on a telephone. And the first thing I do, you know, when I walk into any office, I will walk around to every desk and say hi to every single person, because people are not fungible, you know, and they're an integral part of the organization, and want to make sure that everybody understands that they are respected and they add to the performance of the organization.
So what are the changes you've seen in this 11-year journey in terms of what customers, clients expect from Avis & Young, and what you feel you need to deliver to be distinctive and unique in the marketplace?
You know what? I think how we're executing is the difference. The change, I think, is an industry issue. The change is clients value over commodity. And it's, you know, it's an awkward thing to say. What we do for a living is not going out of vogue, but you're clearly seeing the commodity nature of what we do, whether that is processing a transaction, project management, property management, where there's a commodity process at the core of what we're doing. Clients are saying that's fine, but it's going to be viewed and paid at that level. What clients are looking for and what they're happy to pay for, and this is always the case with any service vertical, is value. And so any company who isn't changing how they go about their business and focusing on the value-added service delivery to the client, they are missing out, or they're doing that at their own peril. And we're starting to see things that, quite frankly, are worrying me a little bit, that we're using technology as a crutch. And quite frankly, the technology that exists in our space and many other spaces, you know, especially if you hear artificial intelligence, virtual reality, it's coming and it's going to be awesome, doesn't really work today. And I think that we're throwing some things, whether it's holograms, whether we're talking about big data, it is important. Some of it's here, but some of it's going to take 3, 4, 5 more years to work. And all in all, what Avis & Young is focused on is what we can deliver really well to the client and keep investing in the things that we need that will work in the future.
Have you found some cases where there was a technology solution, quote unquote, to some problem you were trying to deal with for a client, but your gut told you that there was a face-to-face need that was more important than just using the technology, which might have been easier?
Yeah, let me just approach that question just a tweak different. I believe that human beings using great technology to either automate or mechanize a process is what delivers value to clients. And kind of the age-old conversation for, you know, for service verticals, clearly for the real estate industry, are CRM systems, so client relationship management. The technology isn't where the power is. It's the behavior and the usage of the technology. Well, it's no different and as to how we're servicing clients right now. And the human beings, the top talent, the value-added provider who employs technology to deliver a service and a solution, that is the value. That is what clients are looking for today. And unfortunately, there are some pieces of technology that have come out and they're already 4 or 5 layers back in terms of their ability to, you know, to really deliver. And clients and or signed up to something that there's already a product or a piece of technology that's, you know, that's much better. And so there's a, you know, a natural tension at the moment in terms of what's going to be here today, which is the best in class, and what's coming. And what's coming, I think, is awesome. But you just have to wait a few more years for it because it's not quite here yet. Artificial intelligence, you know, if you talk to medical providers, they know it's the future. They know that they're going to be able to diagnose and maybe even have surgery implemented through the use of artificial intelligence. Problem is, you can't use it if it doesn't work. You're dealing with a person's life. A little different. We're not dealing with anybody's life, but we're dealing with people's a financial being. There are pieces of technology that work better than others right now. The great news is it's all coming.
What are the markets that you see as the strongest ones in terms of opportunities for Avis & Young? And where are you seeing weakness and keeping an eye on things to make sure that you're positioned if the markets turn?
We are looking at the U.S., of course, is, you know, is still a dominant player in the real estate services field. The UK, Germany, France, China, obviously, and Hong Kong, you know, starts, but Japan, India, Singapore. But all of a sudden, South Korea is a dominant force. Capital flows that are moving out of South Korea all across the globe, clearly into the US, clearly into Canada, clearly into the UK, is now coming from places like South Korea. So where you look at the engines of growth, where you have population, where you have the headquarters of businesses, these are the places that real estate thrives. You know, a little known fact is, you look at Canada with all the money, and it is an amazing place. We are so proud to be a Canadian company, and we proudly show the maple leaf, you know, everywhere. But you do also have to understand that all office space in the entire country fits in New York. So it's always a matter of relative size.
Right. Are those capital flows that are coming from South Korea because of opportunities that those companies see elsewhere in the world, or is it because of concerns over stability in that region?
Both. You know, we saw this with Russia at some point. We saw this with China at some point. We've seen this with the South American countries. It's both, but you're absolutely seeing some pretty mature, astute investors who see opportunity in North America, and they are putting, you know, their money to work.
When you are keeping your eye on things that might be indicators of the market going south in some geographic area or in some asset class, what are the things that you particularly like to look at?
You know what? You have to go asset by asset, class by class, very, very differently. Okay, so let's talk product types. If you didn't have GDP growth or GDP stability, I'd worry about all of them. From an office perspective, if you didn't see employment growth, you know, you'd be a little worried. But I'm going to pause for a second and just say, I think it's also overlooked that you're talking about a planet of 7 billion people. Most sources will tell you in the next 50 years, this is going to be a planet of 10 billion people. Now, you would expect that the population growth to be in some of the countries that house the largest populations in the first place. Makes some sense. But when you add 3 billion people, some of what's being thrown around from some of the major sources of information say, for example, that in order to put 3 billion people more on this planet, that you have to start building 1 million square feet of housing per day, every day. So I think that there's a macro trend. And specifically, we are bullish on the acquisition that we've made at GVA because we think that everyone is looking at Brexit as a long-term problem when we know that Brexit is a problem, but is a short-term problem. We launched this company into the teeth of the middle of 2008. The world was falling apart. That's exactly when we wanted to merge this company and start to grow. And so the downside in our industry, our interest rates skyrocketing. Well, it looked like they were going to, but they're not, and they're going down. There's GDP stability, employment growth or stability. Things are actually pretty good out there. Now, if you're a retailer, you're suffering from the Amazon effect, and we had too much retail property in the US. Canada has less of a problem with that. The UK has slightly less of a problem with that. But we have macro trends that very simply tell you where you should worry. And then you have more of the micro influences, like a change in logistics and distribution that has changed kind of the retail community. But that also gave birth to a white hot industrial sector. People are worried about shrinking space in office, and all of a sudden the flex office providers stepped up. So there's more to come here, you know, in terms of dissecting the data in front of you. I am extremely bullish. I would love for there to be a correction in terms of pricing, because I don't think it's sustainable for cap rates to be as low as they are. But with that said, I have never seen in my 35 years, I have never seen the amount of capital out there to be put to work in debt and equity. I have never seen this amount, and that bodes really, really well for our industry.
So you said earlier that you have a pipeline of, I think you said $2 billion worth of business that you're looking at bringing into the company from other companies in acquisitions. What areas of the world are you looking to expand to next?
Well, you know, it's obvious. If you take a look at our platform, we have affiliates in certain countries that we want to either acquire or acquire companies in those countries. India is a place that we want to open up offices. Australia is a place that we want to open up offices. We still haven't quite filled in a Seattle for ourselves. You know, we're pretty good. You know, in Canada, we're one of the top three there. We've got five offices open in Germany. You'll see something out of us soon for the Netherlands. But again, going back to it, if you think of a major market where real estate inventory and decision makers sit, those are the geographies that we want to be in. And then you look at what type of property is the focus, whether it's going to be retail, industrial, office, multifamily, or hospitality. And we will put the combination of what we call the 2x5x5, the two client sets, owners and occupiers, the five service lines that each of them need, and our five core product types. And those are the places that we look to invest.
Mark Rose is Chief Executive Officer of Avison Young, the full-service global commercial real estate company based in Toronto. Thank you for being with us on the podcast today.
It is my absolute pleasure. Thanks for making it available.
We'll be back in a minute.
Shalom. This is Rabbi Richard Address. Join us for our podcast series from Jewish Sacred Aging entitled Seekers of Meaning. We'll explore some of the issues and events that impact ourselves, our families, and our Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging.
The Seekers of Meaning podcast airs every Friday morning at 8 a.m. at JewishSacredAging.com. Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill.
Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. Investors Bank, headquartered in Short Hills, New Jersey, is a full-service community bank serving customers since 1926. Investors recently originated 11 larger commercial real estate financing transactions valued at about $171 million. The commercial mortgage loans were primarily used to refinance existing credits on multifamily housing complexes, office structures, and cooperative apartment buildings. The bank's CRE lenders also negotiated construction loans and completed various lending contracts in the $1 million to $3 million range. The bank takes a balance sheet lending approach to its commercial real estate portfolio. That means the bank keeps the loans in-house and works closely with its borrower customers on keeping the loans performing properly. The bank's commercial lending portfolio also includes more than $2.6 billion in commercial and industrial loans. In recent years, the bank has diversified the portfolio to include more loans to owners of commercial office buildings, industrial warehouses, distribution facilities, and retail shopping malls, as well as healthcare facilities. Joining us to talk about investors' approaches, Richard Spengler, Executive Vice President and Chief Lending Officer of Investors Bank. Under Rich Spengler's leadership, Investors' commercial real estate portfolio has grown from less than $80 million in 2005 to more than $13 billion at the end of June. Rich, thanks for joining us on the CRE NewsHour.
Good afternoon, Steve.
So you folks at Investors Bank just booked 11 larger commercial real estate finance transactions, about $171 million. You're growing your CRE portfolio. What's the current value and what's making it grow?
Currently, on a $22 billion loan portfolio, we've got about $14 billion of it out in CRE. And that's comprised of just under $9 billion of multifamily and just under $5 billion of traditional commercial real estate. We're seeing all different sectors of the marketplace, so there's really not a concentration in any one area. And it's been something we've been emphasizing here at the bank since 2006, 2007.
What are some of the factors that are driving the growth? Is it any particular economic trend, or is it the way developers are working? What's going on?
Overall, it's been a very active market. It's been a busy market. It's been a great run post-recession. We decided in 2009 we really wanted to be in the multifamily space, so we got heavy into multifamilies 2010, 2011. We've diversified a little bit the last couple of years, I would say 17, 18, and now in 19, we've got a bigger emphasis on the commercial side just due to our concentration of multifamily. So we're probably doing more in the industrial office type sector than we are in the multi. It's an overall asset class that is very busy right now, with the exception of New York multi, which, of course, due to the new rent regulations, is in somewhat of a state of flux.
How much of a role is the interest in the urban core playing in the portfolio building that you're seeing? Are you folks working in the urban settings where a lot of the multifamily luxury development is going on, like Jersey City and those places?
Yeah, that's what we're seeing. Most of it is all transit-based. Most of the multifamily growth, whether it's new construction, whether it's rehab, renovation, it seems to be centered around those urban centers and around the transit village concept type. So it's whether it's off of one rail line or another, there always seems to be a connection to some type of mass transit.
Now, you've indicated that Investors Bank is a balance sheet lender. Can you explain the advantages of a balance sheet lender versus competitors who might be doing structured deals?
Sure. So on the balance sheet side, basically what we commit to and what we term sheet or quote is basically going into our portfolio. It allows us greater latitude, greater decision making as far as things that are going to happen prior to closing as well as after closing. A lot of other lenders are not balance sheet. They're selling off the product in the secondary market post-closing, and they're somewhat limited by third parties as to what they can promise, what they can do, and what they can't do. So we're finding that because it's going on our balance sheet, we have greater interaction with the borrower. We get to make more of our own decisions. We participate in a lot of different asset classes. We offer a lot of different loan types, And those are all things that the borrowers really seem to like.
So there's some value to staying close to the borrower and being actively involved in a relationship with them.
Yeah, what we see, most of our loan transactions are not standalone single transactions. We get loans in for approval, you know, on a daily and weekly basis. When we look at it, most everyone is a repeat customer, 4, 5, 6 loans here. We offer a lot of different types of loans. We do 5, 7, 10, 15-year loans. We do recourse, non-recourse, burn-off recourse. We do owner-occupied. We do investment. You know, we do the owner-occupied residential homes for people when they buy them. So we kind of cover the full gamut of different types of loans. Many of those other lenders specialize in one area. You know, a CMBS shop will be a great shop for, you know, a very high leveraged but a non-recourse type of transaction. So when a borrower needs recourse, they can't go that route. Now, you know, a life company may be something entirely different with a very low leverage, low LTV, but a great interest rate. We're kind of in between. You know, we do construction loans. We do non-recourse, you know, AAA type properties. We do bridge loans on transitions. So we offer a full gamut, which, you know, with the real estate community, I think they like knowing that they can go back to the same institution no matter what the asset type is.
So as you look ahead over the third and fourth quarter, what are you forecasting in terms of CRE loan production?
All right. I'll forecast that if you can forecast for me, Steve, where the long bond is going.
Yeah, right.
Because I'm looking at it today with a 159 long
bond.
They're
inverting, right? The last time I looked.
I'm not sure where any of it is going. You know, unfortunately, you know, we lend off of a long-term rate and we raise deposits off of a short-term rate. So it's a very challenging market. It's been challenging, you know, the past few months, and even the past couple of weeks have gotten more challenging. You know, our cost of funds is not dropping as fast as our cost of loans. So the interest rates on loans have more pressure on them than interest rates on deposits. And, you know, there is an implied floor here that we can only take a loan down so far. And so that is our biggest challenge right now, is actually being able to price loans competitive relative to our deposits. So depending on how that shakes out for the rest of the year, that is my biggest concern. You know, life companies do not offer deposits. They have a different source of funding. When rates go up, we tend to be more competitive. Instantaneous rate shocks. A lot of other people move their cost of money very quickly. They move their interest rates very quickly. So in a quick up market, we have a big advantage. But by the same token, in a quick down market, you know, we don't reprice CDs or money markets, you know, instantaneously. If you have a CD with us that's a 6-month CD, that rate's not changing for 6 months.
Investors Bank is a regional bank, $27 billion in assets or thereabouts. How do you compete with the larger banks that are very active in the New Jersey, New York metro market? What is there a secret sauce that you guys use that makes you different?
You know, once again, I would say it's because we cover so many different facets. You know, once again, a lot of other banks, they'll have different departments, different areas. Maybe they only do certain types of loans. Because we do a, you know, broad base of a lot of different types of loans, I think that's something that gets us out there in front of everyone. I think the fact that we're located here, New Jersey, New York, a couple of headquarters right here in Short Hills and New York City, access to people is very good. I always say that to people, you know, you're much quicker you're going to get our president or our CEO out there for a visit than you're going to, you know, one of the large institutional banks that are nationwide.
Rich Spangler is the executive vice president and chief lending officer of Investors Bank, which is headquartered in Short Hills, New Jersey. Rich, thanks for taking the time to be with us on the podcast today.
Anytime. Thanks, Steve.
And that'll do it for this week's edition of the CRE News Hour. Don't forget to check out our audience survey by clicking on the purple Take the Survey button below the podcast player on the show page for this episode. And please consider becoming a financial supporter of our podcast by clicking the Patreon button. If you have comments about our program or a story idea that you'd like to see us cover, send me an email. The address is steve@statebroadcastnews.com. You can also leave us an audio comment by using the voicemail feature on the right sidebar of our website at statebroadcastnews.com. We tape the show every week in our studios in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For everyone at the CRE News Hour and State Broadcast News, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.